Everybody, you've got a Bible. We're going to be in John chapter 13 this morning. John chapter 13, as we continue with our series that we're calling Memorize John, where we're presenting a graphic or an image for each chapter to help us remember an event that took place in each chapter, or hopefully helping us remember the main ideas or the main things that happen in each chapter of the Gospel of John. We've made it through 12 so far. Those 12 images are hanging on the wall. As we move into chapter 13, our graphic for this morning, which is also in your bulletin. I've already been told once this morning someone doesn't like this picture. That's okay. Hopefully you recognize that this is representative of Jesus washing the disciples' feet at the beginning of chapter 13. And I just want to say I'm not preaching from that event in chapter 13 this morning. Kate, who was with me last Sunday, who had not, you know, she's been in college, she hasn't been here. And she was confused, like, Daddy, how come you didn't preach from what the graphic was about? I said, well, in that case, the Mary wiping Jesus' hair with her feet, which is what the graphic was about, I preached on that in 2024. I preached on foot washing, the argument with Jesus and Peter over foot washing. I preached on that in 2024. So I'm trying to pick out different things that I haven't preached about, at least recently, in covering these. But that's what this represents. But I do want to take a step back and set the context here, because we are squarely in the end of Jesus' life. I mean, we are in the last days of his life. Most likely the events that take place in chapter 13 are on Thursday. Jesus will be crucified on Friday. What we looked at last week was in chapter 12, what is referred to as the triumphal entry, which most likely took place on the Sunday before that Thursday, coming into the city of Jerusalem. And this is the time of Passover, the time of unleavened bread. Matter of fact, John will begin this chapter saying before the Passover. We're not going to take time this morning to try and reconcile when the day of Passover was and whether or not the meal that they observed in the upper room was the Passover meal. We did a lesson in our series on feast, festivals, and holy days about Passover and spent a lot of time in that lesson talking about the Last Supper that Jesus enjoyed with his disciples. But that's the context here. When chapter 13 begins, he is in the upper room, what is described as the upper room with his disciples. John does not provide the details of the acquisition of that room, as the other Gospels do, the Synoptics, as I often refer to them, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. When chapter 13 begins, they are in the upper room. And as we talk about the outline this morning of the chapter, you've got this event at the beginning, which I've simply labeled as the washing by Jesus, which is the opposite of what you would expect to happen. You would expect, you would not expect the leader, the master, to be the one to take the role of the servant in washing their feet. But clearly, this was part of the lesson Jesus was trying to teach. And Jesus, you know, even going back to the triumphal entry, we think about Jesus, we call it the triumphal entry. But Jesus actually rode into Jerusalem as a commoner, not as a conquering king. He rode in on the colt of a donkey. The people made a big fuss about it, but Jesus was riding in as a commoner. He, you know, as Paul tells us in Philippians 2, he emptied himself to become man so that he could die. And Jesus, when the disciples come in, he takes the role of the servant in washing their feet. And again, that leads to the conversation with Peter. And even in the midst of that washing, Jesus alludes to something we're going to talk about this morning. Now, what we're going to focus on in the sermon is the latter half of this chapter, verses 18 through 38, which I've left three blanks in there from this chapter. And this, I think I've labeled this in your hand, in your bulletin. By the way, the backside of your bulletin, you have a handout, an outline of the lesson. It's really three pieces of bad news that Jesus delivers. And before we jump into that text, I actually want you to go to chapter 14. I realize we're not there yet, but I want you to go to chapter 14. And in chapter 14, Jesus is speaking. And you have to remember, and I say this all the time, when John, the Apostle John, wrote this gospel, there were no chapter breaks. Chapter breaks were added later, so the topic has not changed here. But Jesus says, "Let not your hearts be troubled." And if we just start there, we miss the greater context of why he's saying that. It's not just in general that, you know, hey, the Jews are trying to kill Jesus and we're in the middle of Jerusalem where the Pharisees are trying to get at him. It's not just that. But if we take a step back and we look at chapter 13, coming after Jesus washes their feet, Jesus delivers bad news after bad news after bad news, at least from their perspective. Boom, boom, boom. And at the end of those three pieces of bad news, he tells them, let not your heart be troubled. But one of the big messages to me of this is, similar to what we talked about back in chapter 11, with the raising of Lazarus. You know, in that lesson, I chose to focus on how you had the fears of two groups of people. You had the disciples who were really afraid about going back to Jerusalem because they knew Jesus, that the Jews wanted to kill Jesus. And they thought, if we go back with him, what's likely going to happen? We're going to die too, right? And then you have Mary and Martha, who they are afraid because their brother is ill, and so seriously ill that they send and ask for Jesus to come back to Jerusalem, even though they know they're trying to kill him. And so when you look at how Jesus responds to those two fears that they had, he really responded in the opposite way of what we would expect. Because when Mary and Martha said, "The one you love, Lazarus, is ill," what does Jesus do? He stays. He waits. He doesn't come immediately, which again is the opposite of what we would expect. And then the disciples, after he's already told them that Lazarus' illness is not going to lead to death, after a couple days he goes, "What? We're going to go back to Jerusalem because Lazarus is asleep." And they're like, but they're trying to kill you. And we talked about how in Jesus doing the opposite of what they would have expected, it allowed him to show two incredible things about his nature. One was his humanity, in that when Lazarus died and Jesus is having a conversation first with Martha and then with Mary, what does Jesus do? He cries. He shows his humanity to all of those who are around. But then immediately after showing his humanity, even though he knew what was going to happen, what does Jesus do? He does the impossible. He tells Lazarus to walk out of the tomb. And so because Jesus responded in the opposite way of what was expected, he was able to demonstrate his incredible power and his humanity in that event. And what he was asking for everyone involved in that, the disciples and Mary and Martha, was trust me. Trust me. And I think we all find ourselves in those situations where it feels like everything in the world is against us. Or I'm up against a mountain and I don't see a way over it. I don't see a way around it. I don't see a way through it. I don't know what I'm going to do. And it's almost like you can hear Jesus saying, trust me. Like Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. Again, not necessarily here on this earth, but we have to trust that Jesus is working for our eternal good in the circumstances of our lives, if we continue to love him and show allegiance to him. And so in this, we have these three pieces of devastating news that Jesus is going to deliver, but yet each one of those things serves a purpose for God's greater will, God's greater good. Okay, so follow along with me. Does that make sense so far? We still awake? We awake? Everybody good? Okay, so here's the first one. Here's the first piece of bad news. And it is Judas's defection. Judas, this is Judas Iscariot. Technically, there were two Judases who were apostles, Judas Thaddeus and Judas Iscariot. This is Judas Iscariot, son of Simon Iscariot, who is, those of us who know the Gospels know he is the one who betrays Jesus. And it's at this moment that Jesus tells the 12 who are gathered there for this meal. They're gathered around the table. One of you is going to betray me. Now, already, by the time they meet in the upper room, Judas has already met with the chief priest and has accepted, famously, the 30 pieces of silver. Now, when we last talked about John, last week, we looked at the triumphal entry, where Jesus is coming into Jerusalem, and what happens? You have this great crowd who gathers, and they've lined the road across the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem. They've put palm branches on the ground. They put their cloaks on the ground, and they're chanting from the Psalms. They're saying, "Hosanna, save us!" And the Pharisees are watching what's happening. Now, the Pharisees, in conjunction with Caiaphas, the high priest, they have decided, we got to take this guy out. We got to take him out. But when they see this great crowd, they're talking to each other. John records this. They're talking to each other. And to paraphrase, they're kind of like, we've lost our opportunity. And why are they saying that? Because half the city of Jerusalem is now following this guy. How are we going to take him out when he's got so many followers? Well, by the time they're in the upper room just a few days later, that problem has been solved. How? Because Judas went to them desiring to make money. He went to them and said, I can deliver him to you. And we, those of us who know the story, you fast forward a little bit, how did he deliver? He delivered Jesus into their hands when Jesus was there with only his disciples, only those 11 men, not the great crowds. He brought them to the Garden of Gethsemane. Judas was going to solve their problem. And in this meal where the 12 are gathered with Jesus, Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me. Now, I cannot imagine what they must have been thinking. The other Gospels, not John, but the other Gospels record that they were filled with sorrow. It had to have been devastating news. Just like if we learned that one of our number was going to betray this church, right? It would be devastating to find out that maybe a longtime member of our congregation was going to go out and commit, treacherous acts against us. It would be devastating to learn that. And Jesus even goes to the step of saying, whoever I, after Peter gourds John into, or goes John into saying, hey, ask who it is. They don't necessarily understand that he's pointing at Judas when he says, whoever I dip the morsel of bread and give it to him. And then he tells Judas, you go and do. Because they're a little confused, but it tells us that they're upset. They're upset. But ultimately this all serves a purpose. Judas made a choice. I am fully convinced that Judas had the free will to make this choice. Scripture tells us that he gave in to the temptation of Satan. But he made a choice. He made a choice, and through that choice, God's will is fulfilled, right? Because what the Pharisees didn't know when they were saying, hey, we've lost our opportunity to kill this man, was that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem to do what? To die. He was coming to Jerusalem to die. And God, using the choice that Judas made, brought his will to fruition. So the first piece of bad news is, and again, I'm going to hit the high points here, verses 18 through 30, but the first piece of bad news is that one of you is going to betray me, is Judas's deception. Oh, by the way, I have a mistake in the handout. I know you think I'm flawless. I get it. But I have a mistake where I have out beside, he's already accepted payment from the chief priest to deliver Jesus, and I got a whole bunch of verses that are cross-references. The one in Matthew should say Matthew 26, not Matthew 28. So correct that if you would like. But the second one, right after Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me, and he points out Judas, and Judas leaves. And again, there's some confusion. Some thinks that he's telling him to go prepare for the feast. He then tells them about his own departure. And you heard this in the reading this morning that Mike read. That right after he says, one of you is going to betray me, he then says, I'm leaving. Go with me to the text. I'm going to go down to verse 31. When he had gone out, that's Judas, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. Little children, yet a little while I am with you. You will seek me, and just as I said to the Jews, so now I also say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. And if you look in the handout, I've got a reference there to John 7, 33 and 34, John 8, 21. Two times Jesus had told the Jews, when he was speaking to them, that I'm going to leave and you can't follow me. Now he's telling the 11, I'm leaving. And again, if the fact that one of them was going to betray him was devastating, how much more devastating is it to hear that your master, your leader, the center of your world for the last 3 years is going to leave and you can't follow him? You can't follow him. I remember back when I worked at St. Thomas Hospital. This is a long time, 20 years ago. I had a boss who was my biggest advocate in the world. I mean, like, she would do anything for me and treated me that way. I mean, treated me extremely well. Much better, honestly, than I deserved to be treated, but treated me extremely well. And I remember one day I came in and I found out she's gone. I was terrified. Because it was all of a sudden like, I no longer have that advocate that's right there with me. I no longer have that person that's there fighting for me, that's making sure that I get taken care of. And let me tell you, my fears were well-founded because my life was miserable after that, in that job. But I was nervous. I was terrified. I cannot imagine what they were feeling. Because Jesus, I mean, there's already a plot to kill Jesus, and now Jesus says, I'm going to leave you. Well, what about us? What about us? But what they don't know is what? He has to leave, again, to fulfill God's plan, to fulfill his mission. He must leave. He came for the purpose of doing what? Being the sacrifice for us. So he has to leave. But then he tells them this, and this is like a little bonus lesson, because this is not bad news. Matter of fact, this is fundamental Christian life 101, okay? He says, a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, just as I have loved you. And I think part of the reason why this is new is because Jesus being on this earth and the event that he's about to complete is new. And what he's saying is, the commandment I'm leaving you with, as I leave, what I'm leaving you with is, the love that I am showing to you, I want you to reflect that into the rest of the world. I want you to show everyone else the love that I have shown you. Later, John, the Apostle John who wrote this gospel, but in his letter that we call 1 John, and I've got multiple references in the handout, 1 John 2, 7 through 11, chapter 3, verses 11 through 18, chapter 4, verses 7 through 21, where over and over and over, John examines this idea of reflecting the love of Christ toward our brothers and sisters. And at the end of this, in chapter 4, he makes the implication that the reason why this is so vitally important is because for the people who are on this earth, the only way they are able to, quote, see God is in the love that is shown by those who are his followers. He says, no one has ever seen God. It's only that they're able to see God by the way his disciples treat everyone else. He says, hey, I'm leaving, so you've got to show the world my love. That's your responsibility now, to show them my love, to reflect my love into this world. So, bad news, I'm leaving, but with a new commandment, to love one another. And again, why is he leaving? He's leaving to fulfill the mission. Now, the third piece of bad news are Peter's denials. That Peter is going to deny Jesus. And this comes up in conversation because Peter is upset that Jesus said he's leaving. Go with me to verse 36. It says, Simon Peter said to him, Lord, where are you going? He says, Jesus answered him, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow afterward. And Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? Again, I can only imagine how upset he is. No, I don't want you to leave. I want to stay with you. And he says, I will lay down my life for you. And what does Jesus say? Will you lay down your life for me? He says, truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me 3 times. And most of us know how that played out. After Jesus is arrested, when Judas brings the crowd to him in the Garden of Gethsemane, after he's arrested and Jesus is in front of the Sanhedrin, the highest court among the Jews, Peter is in the courtyard doing what? Saying, I don't know the man. Now, again, I don't know if everybody else heard this or not, or if this was a one-on-one with Peter. But whatever the case, we know it had to be devastating to Peter to hear it. But in Luke's account of what transpires here, it's recorded that Jesus told Peter that Satan had requested to sift him, which brings to mind Job, you know, Satan wanting to test Job, his faith, to sift him. But then Jesus, in response to that, he says, I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail, and when you have turned again, okay, turn again is the same idea as repent, right? To turn in a different direction. And I think what Jesus is saying is, you're going to be sifted by Satan in this. But you're going to come back. You're going to come back from it. And I even take from that, you're going to be strengthened by what you go through over the next few days. And then what does he say? Once you've turned again, strengthen your brothers. Strengthen your brothers. What happens to Peter? Peter denies him 3 times. Rooster crows. In one of the accounts, it talks about he catches an eye with Jesus when Jesus is in front of the Sanhedrin. But then what happens? Peter sees Jesus after he's come out of the tomb, right? Approximately 50 days later, I say approximately because it's hard to know the exact timing, but approximately 50 days later, right after Pentecost, Pentecost was 50 days after Passover, but after Pentecost, in Acts chapter 4, where is Peter? Peter's in front of the Sanhedrin. Why is he in front of the Sanhedrin? Because he healed a man at the gate called Beautiful and preached a sermon afterwards. And they arrested him for it. And they asked him the question, by whose authority did you do this? By the way, they never questioned, was it done? Because the man is standing in their midst. He's standing right there. So they never go, you didn't do this. They said, no, by whose authority did you do this? And remember, 50 days before, he's going, I don't know this man. Even cursing and saying, I don't know him. 50 days later, he's in the same place that Jesus was. And they say, by whose authority did you do this? And he said, by the authority, the power of Jesus. And Peter went from one who was rash, impulsive. I feel like I'm describing myself. He was rash. He was impulsive. Flying off at the mouth, bragging, and ultimately denying, to one who stands up in front of the Sanhedrin and said, I did this by the power of Jesus. And then when they said, don't ever speak his name again, he goes back to the disciples and he prayed with them, give us the courage to keep doing this, to keep preaching his name. And he's back in front of the Sanhedrin again in chapter 5 because they said, you keep saying his name. You keep preaching in his name. And it got so bad by chapter 12 that they were ready to kill him. They were ready to kill him. What did Peter become? Paul described him as a what? A pillar in the church in Jerusalem. I think God, just like God used the choice that Judas made to fulfill his plan, God used the choice that Peter made to strengthen Peter for the service that he was going to perform for God's kingdom. And so you see, with the bad news after bad news after bad news, what did God accomplish? You could say with the bad news or in spite of the bad news. What did he accomplish? His will. And it was all for what? Our good. Right? And I think when we pick up at the beginning of chapter 14, the Lord willing, we'll look at next time, Jesus is telling the disciples, don't be troubled. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. And I think he would give the same message to all of us who are facing a mountain, who are facing uncertainty. He says, you may not be able to see where this goes. And it may never resolve in this life, but you know what? I got you. I got you. I got you. That's one of the incredible blessings of being part of God's kingdom. Being a follower of Christ, having a relationship with Him, is that we can have confidence that He's got us. He died to save us. All of this was to bring that plan to fruition. Paul will record in Ephesians 1 that God had this plan from before the foundation of the world to save us through His Son. If you're here this morning and you've never accepted what Jesus is offering, and that is eternal good, eternal glory, salvation from sin, you've never accepted that, why not begin that relationship with Him this morning? If there's anything we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation.